found old book of the unfortunate scribd.com and wanted to make audio book of this. Here it is. The Unfortune, Moon Magic. The Unfortune, who died in 1946, left the manuscript of this book which is now published. The Western esoteric tradition, to the teaching of which she devoted her life, covers too wide a field to find full expression in the work of any one writer. But the Unfortune had planned books dealing with other aspects of that teaching than the one covered here. This would have resulted in a balanced presentation in the form of fiction of the main groupings of the teaching. These main groupings, or apathsatm as they are sometimes called, refer to the broad divisions of the temperament of the human being in incarnation and the corresponding approach to truth. A full description of them is given in a chapter of the study course of the society founded by the Unfortune, and an extract is given here. The hermetic path alone is the way of completion. By the hermetic path alone is it possible to attain the goal, and those who go by either of the other paths can make progress in their evolution but will not complete it in that incarnation, but must come back to master the other paths. The green ray or apaganatm path is for the primitive type of soul that has not yet evolved intellectually, the children of nature. Equally is it a corrective for those in whom civilization has deformed the soul and who need to stress the undeveloped in order to bring about a balanced development. Upon the green path and upon the mystic path will be the pathologies of civilization, in addition to those to whom the green ray or mystic path is proper for their evolutionary stage, receiving curative treatment to bring them into equilibrium. In the hermetic are all three paths in equilibrium. The choice of a path depends upon the soul's development in evolutionary time or upon the abnormal bias given it by the constricting influences of a false sense of civilization. Some souls are made rebels by a civilizationatm and some are made cripples. The rebels are dealt with in green pastures, the cripples in quiet chapels. It should be noted that the protagonist of the story, met before in the Sea Priestess, is an adept working deliberately. She is an initiate of the hermetic path. To the 2003 edition, in Moon Magic, Vivian LeFay Morgan, the Unfortune's charismatic AEC priestess from the novel of that name, reappears to work more of her unique brand of magic. She is now living in London, far from the sea, although not entirely disconnected from the element of water, for her apartment overlooks the River Thames. In keeping with the slightly changed nature of her magical role, she has also taken a change of name, now preferring to be known as Lilith LeFay Morgan. Lilith has also chosen rather different type of man to train as her priest in the magic she has in hand. In place of the small town real estate agent dominated by his mother and sister, she now finds Dr. Rupert Malcolm, a highly successful medical consultant at the top of his profession, yet married to a demanding invalid. His earthy masculinity combined with a domestic life of sexual and emotional frustration make him an irascible tyrant to patients, nurses, and students alike. The Unfortune had a great feeling for the sense of place, as she has demonstrated in her evocations of the western coast of Somerset in the Sea Priestess. This sense of place is now extended to London and the river that runs through it. Rupert Malcolm's first awareness of Lilith LeFay Morgan occurs on the north side of the river, upon the Victoria embankment. After finding her haunting his dreams, he compulsively follows her along the stretch from Blackfriars Bridge, past Cleopatra's Needle, to Westminster Bridge over which she turns. She resides on the south bank in an old converted church, whose lighted window can be seen across the river from Rupert Malcolm's own apartments. In the Unfortune's day, this location was composed mainly of warehouses. Today, however, it is taken up by the Royal Festival Hall and other leisure facilities extending down to the new Tate Gallery and the Millennium Bridge. Yet the original building that inspired Lilith's house and temple still exists, although it is located north of the river, about a mile distant from Chelsea Bridge in West Hawkin Street, Belgravia. Known as the Belfry, it started life as a Presbyterian church in about 1840 but was eventually converted to secular use and for a time acted as the headquarters for a somewhat idiosyncratic spiritualist organization. In 1936, a wealthy member of the Society of the Inner Light leased it for Dionne Fortune's use, and it was here that she staged, to invited audiences, celebrations of her rite of Isis, extracts from which are featured both in The Sea Priestess and in Moon Magic. The outbreak of war in 1939 put an end to these activities, but the striking-looking building remains and in latter days has operated as a restaurant. Fortune did not find Moon Magic an easy book to write and made several false starts before she turned to writing it in the first person, in the words of Lilith herself. Then it began to gel. She also had some difficulty in finishing it, probably because of the exigencies of war, which put a great strain upon her energy and organizational abilities. And when shortage of paper had all but crippled the publishing industry, the writing of novels might well have taken a low priority in a busy life. As a consequence, the manuscript was incomplete at the time of her death in 1946. Because of this, the book falls into three parts. The first part, chapters 1, 2 and 3, may be regarded as the best of her early attempts to start the novel and sets up the action, introducing Dr. Rupert Malcolm and his meeting with Lilith, at first telepathically and then in the flesh. In the second part, chapters 4 through 15, Lilith takes over, explaining much of herself and her intentions, her magical temple, and the work that she intends to do within it with Rupert Malcolm as her priest. The third part, from chapter 16 to the end, which brings the magic to a natural close through the eyes of Rupert Malcolm, was provided by a close associate of Dionne Fortune, Anne Fox, later Greig, who attempted to channel the material after the latter's death. How successful she was in this endeavor is for the reader to decide. The completed novel eventually saw publication in 1956, some 20 years after Dionne Fortune started it, and 10 years after her death. Dionne Fortune claimed that she mostly wrote her fiction by allowing the images to rise, letting the characters have their head and listening to their conversations, not entirely sure what the eventual details of the story would be. This applies to the style of her narrative in part 1, as well as the whole of The Sea Priestess and her earlier novels. In part 2, she pursues much the same method, but writing in the role of the main character herself brings about a much more vivid ambience. We might say it gives a more direct glimpse into the soul of the author than does narrative written in the third person. As in The Sea Priestess, there is a fairly close identification of the author with the character in her mode of dress, the large, floppy-brimmed hats, the long cloak, the furs, and the chunky jewelry. What is more, she goes out of her way to justify this mode of attire, explaining that it is not simply the facile exhibitionism of a poseur, but a way of creating a role in which to focus the magical imagination of those with whom she comes into immediate contact. Now that she was writing directly from Lilith's point of view, she began to find that the character was also taking on a greater feeling of independence from herself, which led her to wonder, half in jest, if she had created a kind of aedic familiara for herself, or that the character might well represent her Freudian subconscious. Certainly we are here at the borderline, which is by no means a hard and fast one, between the mental processes of the creative artist and those of the mediating occultist. She recognized that she had a great deal in common with Lilith Lefebvre, but that there was also a great deal that they did not have in common. Lilith revealed far deeper knowledge of magical things and taught Dionne Fortune a great deal she had not known before. Throughout her life, Dionne Fortune was staunchly Christian in principle, if a little unorthodox about it. Lilith Lefebvre, on the other hand, as Dionne Fortune admits, was purely pagan, a rebel against society, and bent upon its alteration, which she intended to achieve by magical means. One strange point in common between author and character is the idea of being some kind of changeling. Oddly enough, a thought that also crosses Wilfred Maxwell's mind with regard to himself in The Sea Priestess. The origin of this story came from Dionne Fortune's mother, Jenny Firth, who confided to her more intimate friends that the child she bore had died soon after birth, but had revived some hours later with a completely different look in its eyes, as if it were another being. This idea Dionne Fortune revealed in a paragraph in the Occult Review, a major esoteric magazine of the interwar years, and it is much the same story that appears in Lilith's introduction of herself in the novel. The claim to being 120 years old we can perhaps best regard as a symbolic statement, deriving from Rosicrucian or numerological lore, rather than speculate what she might have been doing since 1815 or thereabouts. An odd sequel to this melding of author with character is that after the publication of the novel in 1956, a certain confusion developed in people as a TM minds between Dionne Fortune the author and Lilith Lefay Morgan the character, exacerbated by the paucity of photographs of the real woman that were then available. As a result, an attempt was made a year later to lay the character to rest by creating another sequel called The Death of Vivian Lefay Morgan. This short piece entered the public domain in 1962 as part of a collection of Dionne Fortune articles under the umbrella title Aspects of Occultism with the annotation, AO. This fragment, which was mediumistically received after Dionne Fortune's death, is an epilogue to Moon Magic. Other medium concerned was Margaret Lumley Brown, some of whose remarkable work I have edited, along with her story, in Pythonus, Sun Chalice Books, Oceanside, California, 2000. In this fragment, Vivian, or Lilith, prepares for her death and, after taking leave of her friends, is ritually assisted by a fellow senior initiate to voluntarily pass out of her physical body and into the dissolution processes of the post-mortem state, described under the ancient Egyptian symbolism of the judgment hall of Osiris. It is interesting to note the ancient Egyptian ambience of this fragment as compared to the largely ancient Greek basis for Dionne Fortune's Rite of Isis. But as Bernard Bromwich, a London University academic who befriended Dionne Fortune and attended a performance of the Rite of Isis notes, the costumes she used were more Egyptian than Greek. On being asked about this, Dionne Fortune confided that it was the ancient Egyptian overtones to the Greek symbolism that had always attracted her. In any case, Bromwich came away impressed by what he witnessed, writing afterward that it was one of the best attempts I have ever witnessed to stimulate the subconscious by means of a pantomime TM drawn from the more ancient records of the Hierophant's art. While one might question his choice of the word a pantomime in relation to ritual magic, there is no doubt a certain connection between ceremonial magic and the performing arts. One principal difference is that ceremonial magic is performed for the benefit of the participants rather than the spectators, in addition to whatever objective results, via the inner planes or the collective unconscious, might be deemed to accrue therefrom. Objective results were certainly sought by Lilith Lefay Morgan as, in Chapter 15, she tries to explain to Rupert the existence and nature of etheric magnetism, which is given out in any form of human interchange but more so when the emotions are aroused and focused upon a single person. What Lilith is trying to get across to Rupert is that the process of magic requires the two of them to form an imaginative, not physical, relationship with one another. An important point being that magic of this type, although dependent upon the polarity of gender, is not preliminary or accompaniment to erotic games. A physical relationship, should it occur, would simply be the operation of a safety valve if the forces, via the instincts and emotions, ran out of control and would consequently spell failure in magical terms. As she explains, the physical is simply the end result, and we never let it get there. When you and I work together in ritual, you are the archetypal man and I am the archetypal woman. What I do to you, I do to all men, and what you receive from me, you receive from Great Isis herself, for I am her priestess and you represent the people. Telepathy is the active factor, but it is more than that. We are telepathing the group mind of our race, but we are transmitting cosmic forces. This was what was practiced in the temples of the great goddess in ancient times. It is practiced to this day in India, and they call it Tantra. At the time Dionne Fortune was working upon her novel and practicing the Rite of Isis at the Belfry, she was also in close contact with Bernard Bromwich, a specialist upon Eastern religions at the University of London. His research at that time included texts on Hindu Tantra and some of this material he put at her disposal. She began to draw her own conclusions from this in a series of articles published in the Inner Light magazine from February 1939 to August 1940, under the title The Circuit of Force, subsequently published in volume form by Thoth Publications, Loughborough, in 1998, in which she examined what, in her view, constituted a lost secrets of Western occultism. It is of some interest that her immediate successors in the running of her fraternity did not share her enthusiasm for this line of work, and probably not without reason. It is a type of magical relationship that is easily misunderstood, even by sympathetic colleagues, and that, as Lilith had warned, can easily run out of control. But if sex creeps in through the door, so magic flies out of the window, to say nothing of whatever personal and social consequences may result if those concerned have obligations outside their charmed esoteric circle. As Dion Fortune had pointed out years before, insane occultism and practical occultism in daily life, this is an area of esotericism that is fraught with hypocrisy, involving specious claims of reincarnationary links, twin souls, and linked destinies that at root are no more than mutual self-deception. Its most positive manifestation outside of the esoteric world is probably best seen in the function of the poetic or artistic muse, where the artist is stimulated by some desirable member of the opposite sex without necessarily entering into a physical relationship. Examples have abound ever since the troubadours of Languedoc spun enchanting lyrics inspired by inaccessible 12th century ladies, and perhaps saw its apogee when the young Beatrice transported the imagination of Dante into writing one of the greatest works of Western literature. Lilith reveals at the same time something of her high magical intentions and the difficulty of retaining the necessary impersonality of the adept at the end of part 2, and incidentally in the last words of fiction written by Dion Fortune herself, as I thought of him as he lay sleeping in the room below with my cloak thrown over him, there came to me a wave of such intense tenderness that it alarmed me. I must not feel like this towards my priest, I thought, or I shall spoil the magic. And then it came to me that only thus could I do magic with him, the magic that was to be done through one man for all men in order to lift burdens grievous to be born in a world that has forgotten the holiness of the Great Horned One. By this somewhat unusual title, she refers to the goddess Isis, whose head dresses the horned moon, rather than to the god of the witches, old horny. For that side of things, she had already written the goat-foot god with its rite of Pan. By the air burdens grievous to be born, as she has in mind the rigid sexual and social mores of the 1930s. This was a time when, for instance, the heir to the throne of England, who would have been Edward VIII, had just been forced to abdicate for insisting on marrying a divorcee Tilda Copyrightee. At the same time, a play by Charles Morgan, The Flashing Stream, caused something of a sensation, provoking the playwright to justify himself by publishing an explanatory book. Dion Fortune was moved to call it a one of the great plays of all time. It certainly was not that, but its theme, a face of the whole world, would be changed if the experience of sex were considered to be innocent unless its circumstances made it guilty, was close to her heart. Such an idea would be regarded as commonplace today, but it was highly controversial in 1938. The subsequent liberation of sexual mores in the succeeding decades would have been much in line with what Lilith LeFay Morgan was trying to aid with her magical rites. As she later says to Rupert, we have done what we set out to do. Something is present in the world that was not there before, and it will work itself out in its own way. Perhaps it began to do so in the liberating decade of the 1960s. However, for the inner side of the magical experience we must turn to part 3, which reverts to third-person narrative, although expressed largely from the point of view of Rupert. In the magical climax of the novel he finds himself passing through a number of stages of consciousness, as memories of incarnations of the distant past come welling up from the depths of the instinctual and emotional levels. These his rationalizing mind tries to cope with, explain or justify as best it may. Then passing through the levels of consciousness of the personality in the world, He finds himself at a level of higher awareness that transcends all previous doubts and justifications and rationalizations. He feels the beginnings of the gathering of power as the magic starts to work. He feels a tide rising within him along the hollow rod of the spinal column until with a flash the spiritual and physical levels coalesce beyond the bounds of physiology and even of psychology. He finds himself floating among the stars with Lilith as Isis before him. The two have passed beyond personality. They are no longer two circles bounded by their peripheries, but are two centers of radiation whose contact and interchange is like a lightning bolt as the cosmic forces run down through the lower levels, blowing clear all obstructions and blockages. After this virtual initiation, he feels as a man utterly reborn or remade. He has, in other words, passed through a door without a key. This is the subtitle of the concluding part of the novel, and it has been previously defined by Lilith as a door of dreams. It is the door by which the sensitives escape into insanity when life is too hard for them, and the window in a watchtower used by artists. Psychologists call it a psychological mechanism, magicians call it magic, and the man in the street calls it illusion or charlatanry, according to taste. It does not matter to me what it is called, for it is effectual. A here speaks the voice of the pragmatic magician that was Dion Fortune, and in this, the last of her novels, she demonstrates how, and in what way, it can be effectual. The tools of her trade may be the magical temple with its symbols and mirrors and lights, but within that construct is the power of the trained mind and imagination honed into diamond sharpness by an unreserved dedication to the forces of light, as she understands them. Gareth Knight. Introduction. It has been said that when a novelist imagines a situation, he brings it to pass. Be that as it may, when I imagined the character of Vivian Le Fay Morgan, or Lilith Le Fay, as she variously called herself, I brought into being a personality. And in the second book in which she figures, the present volume, she is very far from being a puppet in my hands, but takes charge of the situation. Any fiction writer knows that characters can a come alive, a and that if they fail to do this, the resultant novel is a pasteboard affair. Any reader with experience of the writer's craft knows the difference between dialogue that is a reported and dialogue that is merely written. The truly creative writer records the dialogue he hears his characters using, but I have gone one better than this in the case of Lilith Le Fay. I have let her speak for herself. After the conclusion of The Sea Priestess, she would not lie quiet in her grave, but her ghost persisted in walking. It walked to such good purpose that it forced upon me the writing of this book. I had no clear idea of the plot. 6 times I started the book, and 6 times I scrapped the result, till finally the rejected chapters reached the dimensions of an average novel. Then finally I decided to tell the story in the first person, and Lilith Le Fay took charge. I had not the haziest idea of the plot, and had to write the book in order to find out, nor was I in the least expecting it to end as it did. Some people, perhaps, would call it a piece of automatic writing. I do not know that I should dignify it by that name. I should say rather that I carried out the intentions of the principal character, but in any case I accept no responsibility for either the plot or the characters. They created themselves. It is exceedingly difficult for me to judge of its merits in the circumstances. I have not a very high opinion of it as literature, but it is certainly a psychological curio. It contains, moreover, an amount of very odd lore, much of which I did not know anything about until I read it in these pages. The viewpoint of Lilith Le Fay is purely pagan, and she is a rebel against society, bent upon its alteration. She may, of course, represent my Freudian subconsciousness, and there is admittedly a great deal of me in Lilith Le Fay, but there is a great deal more that is not me. At least I am not 120 years of age, not yet, anyway. Malcolm comes from many sources. I have never been guilty of the bad taste of pillorying my friends. I have known a great many Malcolms in my time, and shall probably know a great many more before, like Lilith Le Fay, I decompose into my component particles, the power that supports me being withdrawn. The house, however, is an actuality. Its doors have been shut in my face, and I go there no more, but it is nevertheless a dedicated place. Those who read this story for the sake of entertainment will, I am afraid, not find it very entertaining. It was not written for its entertainment value. I wrote it, in fact, to find out what it was about. I have put a great deal into it, and there is a great deal more in it than I ever put in. One might even say that the writing of it was a magical act. If it be true that what is created in the imagination lives in the inner world, then what have I created in Lilith Lefay? Malcolm can take care of himself in this world and the next, but who and what is Lilith, and why did she live on after the book about her was finished, and insist on appearing again? Have I furnished myself with a dark familiar? Lilith considers herself a priestess of the great goddess Nature, and as such can claim divine right in the face of all man-made laws. This is a matter in which I cannot judge, for I do not know. I can only know that Lilith lives after a curious manner of her own. She lives for others as well as for me, and it may well be that to some of those who read these pages she will come as a shadowy figure half seen in the twilight of the mind. For to how many have the laws and conventions done a cruel and unnecessary wrong, as to Malcolm? And may there not be for them a way of escape out onto the hills of dream even as Lilith led her lover? These are questions that all must answer for themselves, for as Lilith sang to a weary man, "Ayo, forgotten are the ways of sleep and night," we may well echo the ending prayer of that hymn of invocation, "Open the door that hath no key, the door of dreams whereby men come to thee. Shepherd of goats, O answer thou me," Dion Fortune. Chapter 1. The fine hall of the medical school was crowded for the prize giving. On the dais, under the famous memorial window that commemorated the charity of the founder, sat a long semicircle of scarlet-clad figures brilliant against the dark paneled oak of the background, the hoods of the different universities, crimson, cerise, magenta and various shades of blue, rendering the color scheme even more startling. Above the bands of the hoods appeared a row of faces, bovine, vulturine, vulpine, and in their center, looking comparatively normal among the striking selection of headpieces that housed so many first-class brains, sat the titled chairman who had just presented the prizes. Down in the body of the hall the dark mass of students and their friends and families stared up at this collection of birds of paradise. "Ayo, he oughtn't to wear that colored hood with that colored hair," they said a little old lady, obviously up from the country, to the clumsy young colt at her side who sat nursing a diploma which entitled him to do his worst to his fellow men. "Ayo, he's got no choice. It's his university hood. Ayo, then the man with that colored hair oughtn't to go to that university." A the mixture of magenta and scarlet certainly was an unfortunate combination for a red-haired man, but the granite heart, granite gray face under the brushed back red hair that was beginning to recede slightly on the temples, stared out into space oblivious and indifferent. "Ayo, he looks a proper butcher," I said the little old lady. "Ayo, you're wrong, he's one of the physicians. Ayo, shouldn't like him to physic me. Ayo, don't suppose he could, there's not much physic given in his department. Ayo, what does he give?" "Ayo doesn't give anything. Nothing much you can give. Sometimes the surgeons can operate, and sometimes they can't. He tells them whether they can or they can't. Only chap they take orders from. If he says go in, they go in, and if he says leave it alone, they leave it alone. Ayo, only hope he leaves me alone," I said the little old lady. "Ayo hopes so, too, mother," A said her ribald son with a chuckle, and made a mental note of the joke for the students at E.M. Common Room. Then the singing of "Ayo God Save the Queen" brought the proceedings to an end, and the object of their interest took advantage of his position on the extreme wing of the semicircle to slip quietly off the platform ahead of the crush of his colleagues. His end of the platform, however, was the end remote from the robing room, and he found himself in the passage leading to the refectory still clad in his gaudy plumage and engulfed in a sea of humanity surging in search of refreshments. Pressed up against him by the crowd was a little old lady who stared at him with the same absorbed, impersonal interest that is bestowed on the horse guards on duty in Whitehall. He, not being accustomed to this kind of attention, concluded she must be an old patient. "Eh, good afternoon. How are you keeping?" "Eh," he asked with a curt nod. "Eh, I'm very well, thank you, eh," she replied in a meek, rather startled voice, obviously not expecting to be spoken to.